We are a church of four generations. We care about the children. We care about every generation, and primarily we want them to learn about Jesus. Today we have the opportunity to hear from Jason Struble. He is Dr. Dirt, and I love getting acquainted with Jason the last couple of years because he's from this area. He went to Washington State and got 2 degrees. Yes. He's a Cougar, but he also grew up on the West Side, so he knows about that other university as well.
Right.
Yes. And but what I got excited about with Jason was that he brought his skills to God. He said, God, how do you want me to serve you around the world? And now the last 7 years, he's been working for Convoy of Hope, sharing the hope of Jesus through helping farms and communities and helping women and helping children. And I'm just excited to have Jason share his story with you. So why don't you give him a warm welcome today, Jason.
Well, good morning, and just breathe that in for me. Just breathe. You know what that is? Home. That is like Northwest. It's so good to be back home. I grew up in the Northwest corner, so hit Seattle and go all the way north until you hit the Canadian border and then turn around and see Mount Baker. I grew up at the base of the mountain. I went to Mount Baker High School. That's where I live. But then God transplanted me for my PhD to Prosser. So I was stationed at the Irrigated Agriculture Station out in Prosser, and Tri-Cities was our refuge. This is where we came to Winco. This is where we came to get away. This is where, you know, we never went to Yakima. We came to the Tri-Cities. This was our refuge. So it's just thank you for... Thank you so much for asking me to be here and come back home. My wife is extremely jealous, and so are my kids. But it's been great to get to know Pastor Phil and Anita over the last couple of years. And even in being church today, I could go here. This is normal church. I moved to Springfield, Missouri. I moved to the Bible Belt from the Northwest. So it's been a completely different cultural shift for me that has taken 7 years for my wife and I to adjust. And just sitting here today, I like this place. Like, Jesus is here, and Jesus is normal here. And so I grew up in the Northwest, and when you move to some places where aren't the Northwest, you just go, really? That doesn't seem Jesus to me. But just thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to be here and to share a little bit about Convoy and kind of what it is that you are giving to, but also giving through. We genuinely believe at the bottom of our hearts that we are not just an agency where you send your money, but we are co-partners in ministry so that the church can be the church. And we take that, I carry that notion to my bed every night. So the current role that I'm in within Convoy on all of our international programs is I oversee quality assurance and quality control. So that as you see numbers on the screen today or you see numbers in the brochure, I'm the nerd who knows where they came from, how they got there, and how we're doing effective work. I'm the one who sits over the evaluation team. And if there's something that doesn't look right from evaluation and monitoring, we change action, and we don't just stay for the status quo, because we want to be able to stand before the church who gives God's money through us and sleep well at night in good integrity. I give to One Day to Feed the World myself. Convoy employees all give to One Day. We do it towards the very end of the year. So we know what the sacrifice is to look at One Day's wage, especially when you've got student loans and dumb decisions, and you just go, okay, God, that can take a hit. I know that, and we do not take it lightly. So when I say thank you, I want you to know that our founder, Hal, and all of us, we don't take it for granted that we get to work together. So thank you. And I can tell you that I sleep at night pretty well when I see these numbers, and because I know how they got there, and I know that even in the last, like right now, we started in all of our international workings, which is called an audit. We're doing an internal audit No one asks us to do it, but we've got close to 1,000 places where we do touch points for agriculture, women's empowerment, children's feeding, health, water, connected with and around the local church. And we've got 100, by the end of next month, we'll have nearly 180,000 kids in that program. Over the next 2 months, we are measuring every program center, we call them, every place where we do work or ministry, for 18 standards of operation that we say we want to make sure that there is well, there is clean water source, there is a safe latrine, there is a clean stove so we don't have environmental effects on, you know, in cooking and caloric intake and all these different things. And we're measuring all 180,000 kids to make sure that they are growing the way that they're supposed to. And no one asked us to do it. We did it because we want to make sure that as we continue to grow, that our sample set is correct. Because we trust that if God's going to bless us with his money, we better do it right and we better do it wisely. So my team is completely strapped over the next 2 months because we want to do everything above board so that we can stand before you and say thank you and not have anything hidden. So just, I want you to know my heart, and that's the heart of Convoy and the founder. So thank you, because I know that it's a sacrifice. But it is important that you also know a little bit about me. If I'm going to, you know, kind of give you the Convoy story, but also a little bit about my testimony, because I do love Jesus. And I grew up in a cherry orchard in the far left corner of Washington State. My grandfather was the only registered cherry orchardist on the entire west side of the mountain. By the time I was in 3 years old, I was telling people with as little words as I could how to pick cherries, because they have to, Eastern Washington cherries and Western Washington cherries, ours was a U-pick for pie cherries, and it's a completely different methodology. I will say my grandfather was the very first guy to experiment with Rainier cherries, even on the west side. And so I would go around and tell people how to pick all the way to the same side where by the time I was 16, I could run the orchard. And the only thing I wasn't allowed to do was spray, and that was because Grandpa just didn't want me to be any weirder than I was. But in that time, I grew for a love of just the earth and just creation growing up here. But in order for me to get to the orchard, I had to obviously be born. And you need to know a little bit about my history, because you've got the orchard, but then you've got this lady. Now, when you look at this lady, she doesn't really look that attractive. She kind of looks sick. That's my mom at her wedding shower right before I was born. On the delivery table, she weighed 72 pounds. My mom starved me in the womb because she had anorexia. Then there's this other guy. He's pretty, you know, I really wish I had his build. We honestly think it's because mom starved me that I'm short, because everybody else is like 100, you know, 6 foot tall, 185 pounds, just built, and then there's me. And he had had kind of this weird faith journey that was just not genuine, and the people that he hung out with were not genuine to their faith either. And so he didn't want anything to do with the church. One of my earliest memories as a kid was watching my mom and dad were sitting in a parking lot out in Bellingham at the grocery store. My mom looking at my dad saying, "I'm going to kill myself," and she walks for the freeway overpass. I don't know how long it was, but it seemed like forever to a small kid. So in the middle of all of this chaos of anorexia and mom, I grew up on the cherry orchard because they thought my mom was going to kill me. My dad was an incredible star athlete for Mount Baker High School. 33, 34 points a game were normal. And in the middle of like three different churches, converting to Catholicism so he could marry my mother and, you know, all those different things, he was disenchanted with the church. Somebody from high school came to know Christ and was playing church basketball. And despite my mother's mental and physical looks, they looked past the chaos that was my family, and they asked my dad to play church basketball. Honestly, because they wanted a ringer, but I do think it was because they wanted to see my dad and mom restored to faith. They asked my dad to play church basketball, and if you play church basketball, you had to be at church at least once a week or once a month. So my dad would sneak into a not normal looking Assemblies of God church on a Sunday night, and he ran into authentic men that would hit him on the court, cuss, but then apologize and say, that's not Christ-like. And every Friday night after the game, we would go to Big Scoop, and we'd just get inundated with Christ-like followers who were normal and loved Jesus. Somebody came to town and had a crusade, 9-week crusade, but 2 to 3 days before it was ended, my dad had seen enough and he wanted to come. I gave my life to Christ. Apart from my parents, they weren't Christians yet. The next morning, I walk into my mom's house and I said, my mom's kitchen, and I said, I'm going to be a missionary in Africa. One thing led to another. We had new neighbors come in to the house next door, and the neighbor boy ran over, and I'll never forget, I was in third grade, a little weird, because I had weird parents, and I grew up in an orchard, and he goes, you want to come to church with me tonight? I'm like, well, okay, what are we doing? He goes, it's called Awana. So from third grade to seventh grade, 2 Timothy 2:15, study to show thyself an approved workman who is not ashamed of the gospel of Christ and correctly handles the word of truth. Sunday mornings we'd go to the Catholic church, Wednesday night I'd go to Awana, and on Sunday night we'd sneak into an AG church. God continued to move in my heart and strengthen my call. My parents came to Christ. I was baptized with my grandmother when I was 16, and she was 3 weeks away from her deathbed. My entire family is grounded in Christ because I had some great aunts who prayed down the gates of heaven, and because somebody showed kindness to my dad and asked him to play basketball. So I did the things that you would do to be called to ministry. I went to Bible college. I've pastored. My first pastorate was a youth pastor job where I was at a church of 1,000. I successfully helped take it from 10 staff pastors down to 2. And as we were getting ready to go for missions, God very specifically said, I want you to get your PhD. So I can tell you I dropped out of an MDiv program because I believe the Trinity fits together, and please don't ask me to write a paper on it. That's not who I am. And God continued to move this love for the earth and the orchard and bringing hope to people spiritually. And so as I was pastoring, I pastored for almost 15 years in the pulpit. And as I was going back and forth, I went back and got a degree in environmental science, a master's in agriculture, and then God opened tremendous doors to get a PhD based out of Prosser in Washington State University. Awana, missions, pastoring. I mean, it is important that you know I do have a PhD, and it's a real PhD because it is from Washington State in their crops and soils department. Yes, it is the best. Where, I took poop and I took poop from a cow, put it in an anaerobic digester. What the cow didn't eat, the bugs didn't eat. I then filtered out, made it into a rabbit pellet, put it into an airtight chamber, turned it into charcoal, which we call biochar because it's made for the application of soil, threw it back into the dairy poop and sucked out phosphorus like a magnet and like a sponge, and then threw it back in the soil and used it as a fertilizer source. So I have a real PhD. I did my work out at Hanford, part of my research out at Hanford, out at EMSL. Almost got shot out at EMSL for going out of bounds during a run. And another long story that I can't go down that tangent. I did first service, but I've already talked too much. But needless to say, if it says, don't cross the line, you will get shot, they mean it. So you put all those different things, and how does this all going to fit? What are you going to do with a pastor who didn't destroy the churches that he was at, who has this call for missions, but is a dirt nerd? 7 years ago, I was given the opportunity to work at Washington State, and I had a job offer on the table, and it was a really good one. And after 9 months of like hearing nothing except for crickets from Convoy, I got a phone call saying, why don't you come to Springfield, Missouri? And they said, we want you to design, architect, and run an agriculture program, so that we can continue to go deeper in our strategic planning so that we can break the poverty cycle. And we're looking for a guy. We've been praying for a guy who has a heart for ministry, can talk to Christians, but specifically they were asking for somebody who had a PhD in soils or crops. Who would have thought? Only Jesus. And so in WSU, the dean called and said, "We'll give you a 3/4 truck, your color." My wife looked at me and said, "I can spend your money as a scientist, or I can do what God has called us to do." So I called WSU back and said, "Okay, we're moving to a foreign country called Springfield, Missouri." And I tell you that story from everything from kindness to my journey for two reasons. Number one, I think it's important that you know that my family's destiny was alcoholism, multiple children out of wedlock, and the consequences of all those actions. But because somebody showed kindness to my dad, he brought my family to church, and God grabbed a hold of my life and changed my destiny forever. And I don't care where you're at, where your heart is, and how low you think you've gone, you are never too low for Christ to transform your life. And I don't care what it is that you think you want to do with your life, God will use it for ministry. Because if he can take a guy from an orchard in the Northwest and take him all around the world with a pastor's heart and a PhD from a real university that knows soils, and he can combine the two, he will take anything that you have that you lay before his feet and say, "I don't know how it'll work, but I trust that you will do something good with it." He will. Students, whatever it is that you have a passion and a love for, you lay it at the feet of Christ, and he will do an amazing thing with it if you trust and obey. It is not easy, but it gets easier the older you get. Because you never know where he will lead you. You never know. He may get to a place where he makes you work for a group like Convoy of Hope in the Midwest, where we've got 11 countries where we're doing active ministry right now. And yet, we've got countries that we don't talk about, and refugee response and all these different pieces. But right now, if you talk about Convoy of Hope and how I got here, it makes sense because God knew what he was doing. 11 countries. I named them basically for the kids, so I didn't have to, kind of tell you where we are now. But when we go into a country, one of the things that you need to know is that we do it very strategically. We do our international development in a very strategic way. One day to feed the world, and those things focuses on the child. But a lot of times when you hear the word feeding program, you think in your head a big old truck full of rice being dumped out and letting people fight over it. We do extremely strategic feeding. We go into the most communities in needs, but we do it within the school system. We do it in the school system because we know if we can get a kid who can come to school and we can feed him, especially if that's his only meal for the day, I can keep him up. And if I can keep him awake in school, then they're continuing to learn. And I know that I have them for that piece of time for 3 to 4 years. And I have them, they're being educated, we're giving them the nutritious meal, and they then go and they change their communities. Because an educated child becomes an educated parent. An educated parent can become an educated leader. And an educated leader that has Christ at their heart can change a generation and can change a country. And we don't just go in and think of just the kids. We think about the entire system, the entire poverty cycle. And how do we go in and strategically use our core competencies to be able to transform that community so that we can leave and everything remains? So we do it, and we start looking at women, and we start seeing, okay, we all understand that the women are the center of the home. Statistically, a woman who makes a dollar is going to give anywhere from 86 to 94% of it directly back to the home. A man with that same dollar is lucky to hit 25% back to the home. It's a hard fact, but around the world, that is the fact. So if we can take a woman and we can then empower her and give her business training or agricultural training, she can then transform her home. So we'll focus on those women that are in and around our children's program. And those women are the lowest of the low. Those are women who, we just saw a story from a lady in Ethiopia who right now the grandmother is taking care of some of the kids, and she's just starting into our international, our women's empowerment program. The actual mom is in the back videos, but you can't see her. She's sick in bed and she cannot move. And that's the norm. In some of these communities, the moms will take their kids and they will chain them to the bedpost so that they're not taken at night to be raped. Those are the kind of moms we start to work with. And we give them amazing just business education. And we've seen women who have gone from that to $6,000 in their savings account, U.S., over a five-year period. And when you ask our women, we're getting ready to actually publish it in the International Journal of the Journal of International Development. And you take our programs from the beginning to the last 5 years, and you have a control group. Those who consider themselves to be a leader in their community. Those who haven't been part of our program, 20%. Those who have, 98%. And those are the type of things that you see all along. And it's changing this community and this group. You know, in our women's empowerment program, we have empowered girls, where we go into communities specifically in East Africa where mutilation is a real issue, and where teachers, as a norm, sleep with their students for grades, where parents pressure their daughters to be in marriage by the time they're 11 to 13. We go in and we start basically, it almost looks like a women's lib conference. I remember when I first sat there and began, I'm like, oh my word. But to them, it is so revolutionary to think that a woman can think for herself. And they start singing songs. There's nothing greater than having this group of 200 girls. They're high school girls, and they're singing these amazing African songs. I've got a CD of it. I let my daughter listen to it. But now that she can read the CD cover, no, I will not let you mutilate me. No, I'm not going to sleep with you for the A. That's their songs. And these girls have now gone on to, they've passed their high school boards, and they're going into college. They're becoming nurses, lawyers, and we're breaking that poverty cycle. The kids, the women, and then there's the agriculture pieces. Now, I love the ag piece. That is so near and dear to my heart because dirt's under the fingernail, soil feeds the world, and it's one of these things where around the world, extension is like it was here in the 50s in the U.S., taking basic soil practices, basic conservation agriculture principles. Your plant needs food. It's nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. How do we get it? Compost, manures. And then we do integrated pest management plans. And then we go in and we talk about, we will take it all the way into fertilizer calculations. But it's always about the education. And we do it at the garden scale, where it's a garden scale. And there's no other scientific term to put around it. And you go into communities and you help moms, kids, families grow their own gardens. We work in Nepal. I'll be in Nepal in 3 weeks, and then I'll get to fly over into Sri Lanka. And this community that we work with in Nepal, Kimtung, we got into it after the earthquake. You go into this community, and the ag nerd in me just burst with joy because there is just thousands of vertical feet of terracing. Corn, rice, corn, rice, corn, rice, corn, rice. They were some of the hubs of the center of domestication for rice. So every rice variety that we have around the world passed through this area, coming out of, you know, parts of China and those areas. But no one told them that they could grow anything other than corn and rice. So you go into this community that's been doing agriculture for thousands of years, and their kids are have orange hair because they don't have enough nutrients. With our agronomy staff in the ground and just basic principles, we call it faith gardens, food always in the home. We were up in the community and Pastor Samuel was going there, 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 and he points out, and there's over 120 small space gardens in these communities now that women have, that they're growing for their family, and they've got eggplant and they've got kale and they've got all these different vegetables that they never knew they could grow. Transforming 9,000 years of domesticated agriculture just by saying, you know, you could grow that too, and then showing them how to do it. And it's changing that community to the place where I've sat in this meeting where it's a community center because it is not a church. We're not allowed to have a church there in Nepal. But of course, it's the pastor who always hangs out at the community center. And I've watched these ladies sit there and basically they're coming up with their business plans. And now they're putting a new road through and it will be the hub. And these ladies are now creating a micro business out of the excess produce that they're growing because nobody else is growing anything other than rice and corn. And it's revolutionizing and breaking that cycle of poverty. You know, we talk about the commercial scale. We work with dragon fruit farmers in Nicaragua. And it is purely for cash crop. It is commercial. And we do that in Haiti as well. We pick two or three of the things they can grow, and we grow it for money, and we grow it big, and we grow it fast and with the best agronomics you can. The dragon fruit is that little fruit that you can find at the markets here in the U.S. They're about $8 a piece. You have your juices. They're really good to eat. There, we grew it because it's a cactus, and there was drought coming. Between the zero day and day 365, they call that the zero year, nothing's supposed to grow. It's kind of like just any of the tree fruits that we have around here. I get a call at day 270. They were already at 70% production. That field, which they call God's blessing, was so productive and so unheard of. In the last year, the Nicaraguan government has sent all their extension agents there because we were doing something that nobody else had ever, ever, ever done in history. And it was in a place in a land where nothing could grow, and it was centered through the local church. I was in Haiti, where I've done most of my work over the years. The first 3 years, I was definitely a practitioner. But in this community, we've been there. We've introduced virus-resistant seed, and it's become, I was sitting in this field in July, and I'm looking all around. I'm asking my team. I'm asking the pastor. I'm like, Pastor, what is this? What's the difference? Can we account for any of this? And he starts kind of going like this. He gives me some number that I know is just, I'm the numbers guy, so I know that that's not real. He said, just 2,000 people. I'm like, I knew that I've got 3,000 farmers that have gone through the program, so that's not going to add up. But I started asking, how many people in your church have come to know Christ? How many more kids are in the school? How many people are using virus-resistant seed? He's like, well, everybody's using it. How much seed have you given away? He's like, well, everybody gives stuff away because it's the right thing to do. He's like, well, I can't put a number on that. That's thousands. And now we're moving out of that community because it's completely self-sustaining. We start looking at the different pieces, and we do trainings on all kinds of sorts of stuff, but we do this with 11,000 volunteers. We don't pay any of our volunteers. We don't pay any of our churches. Because we want to build the capacity of the local church. We feel that the local church is our exit strategy. They are our entry point and they are our exit. Because the church, if it's being the church, is outward focused instead of inward focused. So we go in and those 11,000 volunteers, whether they're in a country that is open for the gospel or a country that is closed to the gospel, they're the ones that are doing the feeding. Our staff members all have the DNA of Christ. And they're the ones that are doing all the trainings. Those 11,000 volunteers are church people, just like you. So when we go away, the heart of Christ is still there. We left them with capacity, but Christ was always at the center. It never moved, and he never left. And we just empowered the church to be the church that God has called them to be. You know, you put all those different pieces together and this idea of compassion and this idea of urgency. See, Matthew in 14 and in 19, Matthew 14 and 9 says he was moved to compassion because he saw all the hurting and so he sent out the 12. Or everybody's around him and he's giving his sermons and then the disciples go, these guys are hungry. We got to send them out. And Jesus says, no, feed them. But it says that he was moved to compassion. And you can look at the Greek, you can look at the Latin, and in the end, it means he was moved in his bowels. He was moved in his innards. My cherry orchard grandfather had an issue. And I'll never forget, you could be driving anywhere with him, but if he said, stop the car, you stop the car. And I remember one day we were going to High Notes Corner, and we were going to High Notes and to get some formica because he was a cabinet builder as well, and he ran off into the woods. And I go, "Grandpa, I can see your bald head. What you doing?" He comes back, and I'm like, "Grandpa, where's your hanky?" He's like, "Just shut up." But when it says that God in Christ was moved to compassion, it was an urgency that if he didn't act, there was going to be some unintended consequences. And although it's a crude illustration, I think of Grandpa every time I hear the word compassion. Because every one of us understands what that means, if you put it in the form, to be moved so that if you don't do something, something's going to happen. That was God's avenue for us as the church, to do faith and deeds, to be so moved with compassion that we would stop at nothing to share the gospel, that we would stop at nothing to reach the poor. Anywhere, anyhow, anyone I meet. I'm honored to represent Convoy, who gets to be part of your hands and feet for the compassion of Christ around the world, centered around the local church, so that people can be healed spiritually and physically. But I'm also keenly aware that this church has a purpose and a destiny to show Christ-like compassion inside and outside these doors. Because a church that is normal, loves Jesus with all of its heart, soul, and mind, that understands that food sometimes equals Jesus, sometimes a prayer equals Jesus, sometimes water sanitation training equals Jesus, but Jesus equals hope, can do amazing things in your community. So I just ask you to listen to God and to open your eyes. Even bigger than your eyes are already open. And just say, "God, give me your eyes." So whether it be around the world through Convoy, or maybe even you, or maybe you giving your career and saying, "Okay, God, I'm going to do something for you," that we as the church universal become so moved with compassion for the poor and the suffering that if we don't do something, the consequences are eternal. Can I pray with you? God, I just pray for South Hills this morning and Jason, that God, that you would give us an incredibly bigger heart for compassion than we've ever imagined. That we would be so moved that we have to do something. May South Hills be a beacon in this community. A beacon that says they really do love Jesus. God, I just pray for all of this community. South Hills, all the churches, the Baptists, the AGs, the Lutherans, the Methodists, that God, they would be such a united force of peace and compassion that this community could do nothing but stand up and say, "Now that is a God and a God I can serve." And God, help them to do that. In your name, amen.